Oysters have been considered a natural aphrodisiac for thousands of years and are widely used in many cultures to increase sex drive and arousal. Scientific studies concluded that they have unique amino acids that are known to stimulate sexual desire in both men and women, so I thought this would be a good opportunity to give them a try for the first time. I'm told that oysters are alive up until the moment you eat them, which is something that I wish someone had told me before I decided to try some today. Or rather, maybe it would have been better if I was not told at all. They are definitely an acquired taste, but better than I expected. They come with several different sauces, which probably make them taste better, but it was the consistency which sort of took me by surprise. I tried one from the West Coast and one from the East Coast, and to be honest, could not really tell the difference. But if you know, maybe you can tell me in the comments below. Overall, it was a good experience, and I recommend it if you're the adventurous type. Although they make for a great appetizer, I think I'll stick to something I'm more familiar with for the main course. Not many people know that oysters were a staple food for many civilizations, such as the Romans, but also some tribes of Native Americans, such as the Chumash Indians, that used to live here in Calabasas, where I just tried them for the first time. The Chumash main diet consisted of fish, mussels, clams, oysters, but they also ate sea mammals such as seals and otters. Anthropologists estimate that there were roughly 20,000 Chumash living by Southern Californian coasts at the time of the European occupation, and they depended on the bounty of the sea for their primary dietary needs. Today, Chumash are estimated to have a population of about 5,000 members, many of whom can trace their ancestors to the Channel Islands off the coast of Los Angeles. I made a video recently about the giant human remains found on some of these islands, including Catalina Island, and will leave a link in the description below. Of course, oysters are not the only seafood thought to enhance one's libido by the ancients, and the science for why this might be so probably has to do with the fact that fish and caviar is also packed with nutrients such as B12, sulfur, calcium, iron, and zinc, some of which are believed to enhance one's passion, desire, and drive. In some Caribbean cultures, it's believed that eating shrimp during lovemaking doubles the pleasure, but they're also high in cholesterol, so today I'll just stick to fish. I had Parmigiano crusted halibut with grilled asparagus and beurre blanc, which means white butter, and this dish is definitely better than the oysters, which I'm sure I'll try again if I can find someone brave enough to eat them with me. Whether you love or hate raw oysters, there's no denying that they have a flavor and texture that is entirely their own. For now, I'll just enjoy this fish, and then we can start today's episode. An exotic berry grown in the rainforests of South America is called the acai, and I just happened to be next door to a place that makes smoothies from this nutrient-dense aphrodisiac revered in Brazil and also thought to allegedly lower cholesterol naturally. It's also high in vitamin A, antioxidants, and is thought to potentially increase stamina for men, and is rumored to boost a couple's chances of conceiving, based on a published study in 2015. So, this berry from the Brazilian rainforest may be a superfood after all. Mexican folklore attributes mind-blowing qualities to turtle eggs, believing that they can inspire desire, especially in men, which is one of the reasons that turtles are on the endangered species list in Florida. Palestinian fishermen believe that the blood of sea turtles in the Mediterranean has a similar effect on men, but unfortunately these animals are also an endangered species, so most fishermen from the Levant release them when they're accidentally caught. The ancient Chinese believed that warm snake's blood gave men prolonged arousal and stamina, and the more venomous the snake, the more effective it was thought to be, with some sources even adding some of the venom to the blood to enhance virility, along with some alcohol to make it allegedly safer to drink. No, I will not be trying any for this episode. In the world of the occult, blood has always, since ancient times, been regarded as useful for the purposes of healing, strength, and fortification, as it was thought to carry the soul with it. If a conqueror drank the blood of their victim, it was believed that they could gain the power and strength that previously belonged to them. This was one of the reasons why the Greeks, Assyrians, and Persians were terrified by the Scythians, who, according to Herodotus, killed their enemies and made their skulls into drinking cups. For the ancient Greeks, blood was a magical elixir. Pliny the Elder, one of the greatest historians of the Roman Empire, described the mad rush of spectators into arenas to drink the blood of fallen gladiators. Born in 1560, Hungarian Countess Elizabeth Báthory believed the fountain of youth ran in the blood of virgins and was said to have regularly bathed in the blood of young girls to preserve her youth. While this concept seems to be emulated, at least in part, by modern billionaires who are trying to slow the effects of aging using the blood of young people through transfusions, I would argue that the traditional esoteric motive was not so much about prolonging the individual's physical longevity, but about enhancing one's spiritual vitality. In other words, the alchemical goal was not to make the body live forever, but to achieve spiritual immortality by refining the life force energy to fortify the soul in an effort to retain as much consciousness in the afterlife following the inevitable transition during physical death. There are many ways of judging a man's success. Some people believe financial wealth is the ultimate sign of status and therefore the pursuit of material treasures. Other people feel that health is what is most important, placing the greatest value on vitality. And still others judge a man by his fruitfulness, meaning how many offspring he has managed to produce in his lifetime. If any of these are true, then few can claim to be as successful as Genghis Khan, who possessed all of the riches of the known world and had the stamina and fortitude to establish the Mongol Empire, which was among the largest in history, and the fact that his DNA is present in about 16 million men alive today speaks to his genetic prowess, which is an astounding accomplishment. Let me put it to you this way. One in every 200 men is a direct descendant of Genghis Khan. Another way to look at it is 10% of the men who reside within the borders of the massive Mongol Empire at its peak carry his Y chromosome. He was a man of great appetite and great stamina. There can be no question about it. You're probably familiar with the following quote from Genghis Khan, which was paraphrased in Conan the Barbarian. Quote, "The greatest joy for a man is to defeat his enemies, to drive them before him, to take from them all they possess, to see those that they love in tears, to ride their horses, and to hold their wives and daughters in his arms." So while Genghis Khan was a very prolific lover and successfully passed on the traits for his red hair and green eyes, which are carried recessively by millions of people today, what he was really after towards the end of his life was one thing: immortality. While his legacy lives on through his children and their children, it wasn't enough when faced with his own mortality. We know this because of a letter Genghis wrote to a famous Taoist monk urging him to cross the vast distance to come to his court to teach him the alchemical secret of preserving the life force, harnessing and transmuting the chi, ki, or prana, and bestowing immortality. Master Chang Chun was an eminent Taoist monk and alchemist born in 1148, and thus elderly at the time of his trip. His Taoist sect was known for extreme asceticism, which held that a man's natural state had been lost, or was in a fallen state, but could be recovered through certain ancient Aryan practices, the same internal alchemical techniques utilized by esoteric occult organizations in Europe, such as the Vril Society. Techniques which harness and transmute biomagnetic energy into much higher and subtler forms. Chang Chun was invited or ordered by Genghis Khan to travel to his court, which at the time encamped in Central Asia. The route went through the Altai and Tian Shan mountains and the southern parts of today's Kazakhstan through Kyrgyzstan and then down into Iran and Afghanistan. He was accompanied by his disciple Li Qi Chang, who composed a detailed diary of the journey, and it was published in 1228. I would now like to present to you Genghis Khan's letter of invitation to Taoist Master Chang Chun. Heaven has abandoned China, owing to it its haughtiness and extravagant luxury. But I, living in a northern wilderness, have not inordinate passions. I hate luxury and exercise moderation. I have only one coat and one food. I eat the same food and I'm dressed in the same tatters as my humble herdsmen. I consider the people my children and take an interest in talented men as if they were my brothers. We always agree in our principles and we're always united by mutual affection. At military exercises, I'm always in the front and in time of battle, I'm never behind. In the space of 7 years, I've succeeded in accomplishing a great work and uniting the whole world in one empire. I have not myself distinguished qualities, but the government of the Qin is inconstant, and therefore heaven assists me to obtain the throne. The Sung to the south, the Hui Ho to the north, and the Hia to the east, and the barbarians to the west, all together have acknowledged my supremacy. It seems to me that since the remote time of our Shan Yu, such a vast empire has not been seen. But as my calling is high, the obligations incumbent on me are also heavy, and I fear that in my ruling there may be something wanting. To cross a river, we make boats and rudders. Likewise, we invite sage men and choose our assistants for keeping the empire in good order. Since the time I came to the throne, I've always taken to heart the ruling of my people, but I could not find worthy men to occupy the places of the three and the nine. With respect to these circumstances, I inquired and heard that thou, Master, hast penetrated the truth, and that thou walkest the path of the right. Deeply learned and much experienced, thou hast much explored the laws. Thy sanctity is become manifest. Thou hast conserved the rigorous rules of the ancient sages. Thou art endowed with the eminent talents of celebrated men. For a long time thou hast lived in the caverns of the rocks and hast retired from the world. But to thee the people who have acquired sanctity repair like clouds on the path of the immortals in innumerable multitudes. I knew that after the war thou hadst continued to live in Shang Tung at the same place, and I was always thinking of thee. I know the stories of the returning from the river Wei in the same cart, and of the invitations in the reed hut three times repeated. But what shall I do? We are separated by mountains and plains of great extent, and I cannot meet thee. I can only descend from the throne and stand by the side. I have fasted and washed. I have ordered my adjutant Lu Chung Lu to prepare an escort and a cart for thee. Do not be afraid of the thousand li. I implore thee to move thy sainted steps. Do not think of the extent of the sandy desert. Commiserate the people in the present situation of affairs, or have pity upon me, and communicate to me the means of preserving life. I shall serve thee myself. I hope that at least thou wilt leave me a trifle of thy wisdom. Say only one word to me, and I shall be happy. In this letter, I have briefly expressed my thoughts and hope that thou wilt understand them. I hope also that thou, having penetrated the principles of the great Tao, sympathizest with all that is right and will not resist the wishes of the people. While the quest for immortality is ancient and diverse, in the context of original Taoism, it is quite specific. Immortality is usually simply defined as eternal life, being exempt from death, and unending existence. While Genghis Khan probably to some extent wanted to extend the life of his flesh body, the occult nature of esoteric internal alchemy does not revolve around anti-aging or cheating death, but rather on fortifying other aspects of a person's beingness not acknowledged in modern Western science. To put it in the simplest terms, the ancient Eastern and Eurasian philosophies are concerned with the development and survival of the soul, the consciousness, and nourishing the spiritual or light body that allegedly survives the death of the physical body. This is a big subject, and there's been much written on it, and even more that is only transmitted orally through initiation into mystery schools, but can still be detected in many of the traditions of ancient cultures, such as tantric yoga, which is very different from the type that just involves stretching and holding postures, qigong, which involves the circulation of qi or ki throughout the body, but only works once one has learned how to harness and transmute the qi in the first place. Otherwise, it's nothing more than dancing in slow motion. Meditation, which again, in its esoteric form, is very different from the type most commonly taught today, which is more like just taking a nap. True meditation is not relaxing at all, and is a far cry from just sitting there still with one's eyes closed, as what is happening internally on a subtle energetic level is anything but stillness. There are aspects of nutrition and herbology which I won't get into, as this knowledge can be abused, but it's no secret that many monks consume certain items with psychoactive properties, which, when consumed, some claim can aid in the internal alchemical process. That said, the true heart of sacred internal alchemy, the guarded secret techniques as practiced by pharaohs, emperors, alchemists, philosophers, and monks, has to do with the uniting of the male and female principles in a certain controlled way, which takes discipline and practice, and from this union, creating a third force. This is the true hidden meaning behind all symbolism, which involves two polarities, male and female, coming together to create a third, which is usually depicted as an exalted child. I cannot stress this enough, that this is symbolic and has nothing to do with procreation. The child that is being created is not physical, and is just a symbolic representation of what is happening on a more subtle, energetic level. This spiritual force that is created happens on the inside of both a man or a woman, and is what Taoists call building the immortal body, and in the West might be called a soul, spirit, or being reborn with a light body, similar to the rainbow body in Tibetan Buddhism. To help illustrate this concept, here's a brief excerpt from Taoist master Montauk Chia. So let's have a listen.
So when you do that way and you started to really mixing these two energy into one, right, and it started to form to another body, uh-huh, or we call you inject a seed of the soul or the spirit into the immortal energy, the jing energy, it give life to the another body. That means we grow the soul and the spirit.
Can you feel this happening inside you?
Yes.
What do you feel?
When you turn in your mind in, you feel another life within life.
You feel a life growing inside.
Within the life, yes. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And you can feel then, you can actually aware of it, and it will happen inside you.
So after you grow this body, then what happens after this expansion?
So we call you transfer the consciousness, you transfer your awareness into it. So like a piece of wood, if you burn them, it turns to be heat.
Right.
But it disappears.
Right.
Okay? Now, in physically, we cannot do anything. But when you turn it into chi, it can transform. And you can take that.
Uh-huh. You take the chi.
You can take it. Like if you turn your heart is physically, but when you turn your heart to a pure love, it becomes another energy. Mm-hmm. But that energy, if you don't do anything, it disperses. Mm-hmm. But if you have a container, you put it in, it stays. Mm-hmm. So that's why you need to build a body first. And when you have love, joy, happy, whatever you have, you want to store them, you can put in the body.
And then, of course, you have to have the emotional connection there.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But once you have this immortal body, let's say it grows, mm-hmm. then what do we do with this human experience?
The whole thing is that we call the immortal body, you transfer whatever the physical thing to another body, and when you want to leave the world, you take whatever you transfer and left.
You so leave body, with your body, you transform the body into life.
Another body.
Right.
And your consciousness also go into that body.
Right.
So that body is not dying, but this body are dying.
Right.
So you have to change the dying one into the one not dying, and you can tear it out. So oftentimes in the Tamasa, when they practice to a level, when they left the world, sometimes the body shrink down half of it because they take out a lot of things.
Uh-huh.
That's the same thing like Jesus practiced. Well, after he died for 3 days, his body dissolved and disappeared.
Right. Yeah. Right. So how long does it take to build the immortal body, like someone like who's been practicing?
Actually, 3 years, you do in the first 3 years, you started to prepare it. And when you get pregnant, we don't know when.
You get pregnant with your own immortal seed.
Nobody knows when.
Yes.
But when you keep on doing that, one day you get pregnant. Okay.
Are you pregnant?
Yeah. A man pregnant sometimes not very good, huh? Okay. Now, when you get pregnant, you need to feed them or nurture them 3 years.
The Taoist masters were able to do this and then leave with their immortal body.
Right.
So this is the ultimate practice of cultivating the sexual energy.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I see. So how do you ever ejaculate, though? I mean, or is,
oh, yeah, sometimes. I mean, I have children, but that is what ejaculation. But if not, I'm not ejaculation.
You're not, just for the children. So
many of the world's ancient traditions, including those of Hinduism, Taoism, Tibetan Tantra, Gnosticism, esoteric Christianity, certain Sufi sects, and oral aspects of the Kabbalah, maintain that a person's concentrated life force energy is dissipated and lost at the moment of climax. It's similar to discharging a battery into a ground wire. The energy is gone forever, and one is left depleted. In French, the expression for this is la petite mort, translated to the little death, implying a loss or weakening of consciousness after the carnal act, which is expressed biblically in the story of the Garden of Eden, where after eating the forbidden fruit, which represents the orgasm, Adam and Eve are left naked, which means they're in a spiritually dumbed down and energetically degraded state. Even the ancient Egyptians believed that the act of love was potentially more than just about procreation. They believed that the moment of climax was sacred, and if harnessed in the right way, would become a source of infinite pranic energy, and thus lead to eternal life. One needs only to look at the many mummies left behind to know that they were not talking about physical existence, but conscious existence in the afterlife. They also believed a prolonged and blissful orgasm can increase your life force, or ka, but that the energy currents must be controlled so that the pranic energy is not lost, leading to higher consciousness into worlds beyond this plane. The elixir of life, or what alchemists called the philosopher's stone, has many names and allegedly cures any disease, granting the drinker immortality. This fountain of youth was sought after by many cultures through the ages and is mentioned in various ancient works, including the Epic of Gilgamesh, dated to around the 2nd millennium BC. It's described in Hindu scriptures as Amrita, and some interpretations of the Bible equate it to Jesus' reference to the water of life, which he says will, quote, become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life. While many people perceive these references to imply that there is a literal magic potion that one consumes and is then transformed, ancient mystery school religions teach that this substance is actually derived by way of internal alchemy, where a person's own bioelectromagnetic energy is harnessed, amplified, and circulated, rather than an elixir that one drinks. This liquid gold substance is called chi or ki in the East, prana in India, vril in certain European secret societies, and translates to life force energy, which is available to all races of people, and by extension, all living beings, including animals. Traditions like the Aryan Path, which later was renamed as the Noble Path in modern Buddhism, work to cultivate this life force energy, which at a certain point is said to awaken dormant energy centers in the body, situated along the spine, through the heart, and to the head, also known as chakras, which, when activated, allegedly lead one to heightened states of energetic vitality, meaning physical bliss, psychic awareness, and spiritual enlightenment. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon and through all other major book outlets. If you'd like to support my work, you can do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description. Please subscribe for future updates. Leave your thoughts below. Have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.